China's master plan. Obama's bottomless narcissism and the real crook in the Hunter Biden scandal is Joe Biden. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I talked yesterday about the possibility, and it is only a possibility. I wouldn't even say a probability, but something that needs to be investigated. Whether or not COVID-19 is a biological weapon. Now, we have Biden's directive to the intelligence agencies to look into this, but I don't think we can expect a whole lot from that first, because our intelligence agencies aren't very intelligent. They don't really have good sources in Wuhan. They're not able to penetrate the thick veil of secrecy that the Chinese have erected. All they do is they, quote, they talk to anonymous people who say, we've heard it from other anonymous people, and we can expect this kind of nonsense in this very expensive report due in 90 days. But I think the second reason to be skeptical is that the purpose of these intelligence agencies these days is not to produce any real intelligence. It is to cover for the Biden administration. In other words, I'm talking about the fact that these intelligence agencies have become corrupted. They're extensions of the Biden left and of the Democratic Party. So their goal is not to ensure American interests, but to ensure the interests of the left and of the Democrats. So we can expect their report to be massaged and oriented toward that. The reason this is a very serious situation is that if the Chinese released COVID-19 as a bioweapon, this is a major Chinese jiu-jitsu move. For decades, American strategists have been saying, well, China doesn't really pose a threat to us because what can they do? Are they going to like unleash nuclear weapons on us? They can't do that. America's nuclear force is far superior. America's technology is far superior. We can meet them, by and large, in most battlegrounds and prevail. And the Chinese know that. But this is a whole different kind of warfare, a warfare in which only one side really knows it is fighting. Now, I think it's fair to say that the coronavirus pandemic, whatever its source, however it was released, if the virus leaked out, if it was done deliberately, either way, it has helped China immensely. In fact, it has delivered Beijing the most decisive strategic victory in great power conflicts since the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Remember that that event, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the collapse of Communist Party inside the Soviet Union, produced a huge global shift, made America the sole superpower. China's goal, by the way, is not only to become a rival superpower to the United States, but to displace the United States as the sole superpower. And they're on their way to doing it. Now, under Deng Xiaoping, the guy who first brought about the shift in China away from Mao, more toward a new strategy, a new kind of dynamic capitalist system, although within a communist political structure, Deng Xiaoping's strategy was essentially one of concealment. The phrase he used was essentially hide our capabilities, bide our time. But now China seems to have gone into a more explicit competitive mode with the United States. They're trying to outmaneuver America all kinds of ways. Now they're building up their force in the South China Sea. They have been embedding their technology and supply chains and trade deals all over the world. They have imposed authoritarian rule in Hong Kong with really no resistance from Britain or from America. And their goal is a real transformation of the world order. Now, let's think of the historical significance of this for a moment. Usually, great powers get only one shot at the top of the totem pole. Once they go down, they can never come up again. Think of the ancient Greeks. Think of the Romans. Think even of the British Empire. Once the sun set on the British Empire at the end of World War II, it didn't rise again, and it's not going to. China is one of the few countries that was once a great power. If you go back to the year 1500, for example, China was probably the preeminent power in the world, in force and strength, but also in wealth and learning and knowledge and inventions and so on. And China is making a bid to do this again. It'll be the only superpower to achieve that status, if you will, for the second time. Now, China has this Belt Road Initiative. It's the Belt and Road Initiative. They use investments in Africa, in Asia, in South America. And one of the things they want to do is get leverage over these continents and make sure that all these countries that are getting Chinese investment are going to back China when push comes to shove. Now, it's very important to know that many European countries that are our allies, including Germany, nevertheless do a lot of business with China. They don't want to see, it's not clear that they want confrontation with China. In fact, they've kind of telegraphed that publicly. The Chinese are also trying to help Iran get a nuclear weapon, and they're also trying to help Iran deploy those weapons in Venezuela. The Chinese are providing all kinds of aid, both to Iran and Venezuela, and Debbie, my wife, has talked about it and is very concerned about it. Amazingly, the Biden administration thinks its main enemy is Russia, and they're doing their best to antagonize Putin. And what are they doing with Putin? They're pushing him into the arms of China. I mean, think of the gross stupidity of this. I think they're doing it for domestic reasons. They were like, Trump is in bed with Putin, so we've got to basically have a sort of pretend cold war with Putin. The net effect, of course, is that China gets another major ally, and that's going to make America's life more difficult in the future. To get an idea of the sheer obtuseness, the sheer quixotic idiocy of how many of our think tanks think about China, here's a line from the Atlantic Council. This is its, quote, longer telegram talking about China. Quote, the foremost goal of U.S. strategy should be to cause China's ruling elites to conclude that it is in China's best interest to continue operating within a U.S.-led liberal international order. Are you people on drugs? Do you expect to convince Xi Jinping and the Chinese communist elite? Oh, yes. You know what, guys? It's really good for you to have America in the lead permanently. Let the United States lead the world. You guys can be in the back ranks. Well, we'll pull you along. These are people who either don't have a brain or are essentially up to some diabolical game in which Chinese money and foreign money is causing them to put out these kinds of foolish statements. The bottom line of it is that the United States, under Biden, does not even pay attention to genuine U.S. interests, doesn't even see what a dangerous world we live in. Biden is there babbling, maundering, speaking senselessly about the greatest threat, he just told a bunch of military people, is climate change. Yesterday it was white supremacy. Tomorrow it will be the need to establish the transgender bathroom. So these people are out to lunch, not only in a kind of a dangerous way, at a time when a formidable adversary that understands its own interests is moving stealthily, quickly, decisively to replace us at the top of the heap. For upwards on 13 months now, the public line on COVID-19 has been that this is a virus that came out of a wet market in Wuhan. I mean, think about the fact that this was the dominant media report, even though right in Wuhan, where the virus got out, there is a Wuhan lab, a whole complex of multiple laboratories doing this so-called gain-of-function research, making deadly viruses and doing so under sort of dental office supervisory conditions. So how would a theory like this, so preposterous, and by the way, with not a shred of evidence behind it, nobody tested people in the Wuhan wet market and said, oh boy, these are the first guys that got COVID, so it probably started here. No, in fact, the evidence has always pointed in the opposite direction. The gain of function research is going on. The databases involving what information was being collected were taken offline. We now know, of course, that there were researchers at Wuhan that were some of the earliest people we know about who got sick. These are people actually working on that kind of research. So how would a lie like this become so widely perpetrated? Now, one answer, which I've already given you, is the fact that you've got some corrupt virologists, some real crooks, some people with a direct stake making money off of this gain-of-function research, people like Peter Daszak, people like Ralph Baric, who runs the ECO Alliance at the University of North Carolina, gets money from the U.S. government. These are people who wanted to cover their tracks. And so they got their front men, which is virologists who get money from them, money, U.S. government money that's funneled through the ECO Alliance to other virologists. You guys go forward. You put your names out. We'll keep our names off the list. So they tried to create, to manufacture a bogus consensus. And of course, this suckered a lot of the dupes in the media who basically never graduated from a decent college, never majored in science, are not in a position to know differently. So when a couple of guys in white coats say something, these people start genuflecting. That's part of the story. But there's another part of the story, and that is that when you have a lie, something that's preposterous, it has no evidence, it's sometimes gullibly believed by people who have an ideological stake in believing it, who have another reason, unrelated to COVID, to go, oh yeah, that's right. And it turns out that there is such a lobby in the United States. It's the climate change people. Why? Because the climate change people love any kind of a story in which the villain is nature. Because if something is caused by nature, oh, a lot of hurricanes, they go, wow, that's because of the climate. The climate is changing. We got to act now. And so this story about the virus, about COVID-19 coming out of a wet market, you can see all these climate change, you know, dummies jumping on it. And all these prominent people go, see, this really shows us that climate change is more serious a problem than even we thought. And it's kind of funny to keep reading these dopes one after the other. We can laugh at them now, but these are people who presented their ideas with great aplomb. So let's walk through some of these quotations because they're so illuminating. Let's start, by the way, with the Director General of the World Health Organization. This is this Tedros Ghebreyesus guy. And he goes, the pandemic is a reminder of the intimate and delicate relationship between people and planet. This is the kind of thing that we get. Any efforts to make our world safer are doomed to fail unless they address the critical interface between people and pathogens. This is a guy. This is what passes for wisdom in our time. Here's Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, with the guy with the ruffled hair. He's telling world leaders this quote. The coronavirus pandemic was the product of an imbalance in man's relationship with the natural world. So here's another dope. And here's a guy who goes, oh yeah, I kind of hope it came out of a wet market. Why? Because then I can portray it as consistent with the kind of gobbledygook I've been putting out now for years. Namely that every little thing that happens to the climate can be attributed to climate change. Stop, you know, we got to stop the way that you're living because you're causing the planet to, quote, have a fever. Here, by the way, is... now, by the way, with Boris Johnson, what's kind of funny is that because he's sort of a pseudo-intellectual, he goes, ooh! He goes that this imbalance in man's relationship with the natural world, he goes, it reminds him of book one of the Iliad, because he says in the Trojan War, there was an imbalance of nature caused by the war. Now think about this. If the imbalance of nature existed at the time of the Trojan War, which, by the way, if it even occurred, it might be a fictional war, but if it occurred somewhere around 800 or 900 BC. If the Earth was out of whack then, what hope is there for civilization now? So I don't think Johnson really thought this through. He was trying to do a little display of abstruse erudition that kind of went wrong when you think about the logic of what he's saying. Here's Prince Charles, his fellow countryman. We've had these other disasters with SARS and Ebola and goodness knows what else. This is the kind of thing you say when you're in the royal family. And goodness knows what else. All of these things are related to the loss of biodiversity. This is Charles. Pope Francis. Quote, there is an expression in Spanish. An expression in Spanish. This is the first South American pope, so he's got to resort to his ethnic roots. Debbie's like, wait a minute here. This is a game that I play too. Anyway, back to the sort of, I can't call him the dumbest pope of the 21st century because he's the dumbest pope in probably the latest millennium. Anyway, he goes, God always forgives. We forgive sometimes, but nature never forgives. So in other words, here, this is a guy, you know, it's like sometimes these televangelists go, the end of the world is going to be ordained because of human sin. Here's Pope Francis giving the sort of leftist version of that, our collective human sin, the fact that we use plastic bags and drill for oil and drive cars. Nature never forgives. And finally, there's, of course, our familiar homegrown dummy, John Kerry, quote, yes, climate change is a threat multiplier for pandemic disease. You probably picked that phrase up in one of the climate change conferences. Yes, climate change is a threat multiplier for pandemic diseases and zoonotic diseases. This is a new word John Kerry just learned, zoonotic diseases. So what you have here is, and you get a sense here of the kind of elites we're dealing with, not just, by the way, in America, but all around the world, these are half-educated dopes. And half of what they do is they learn how to dress, and look, if you watch all these people, it's all a pose. Even John Kerry, the way he removes his glasses, puts them back on, crosses his legs. It's essentially the aesthetics of intellectualism. But there's no real thinking behind it. These are not people who investigate rival theses. They have no capacity to evaluate evidence. The emperor here, you have to say, has no clothes. And it's right about time that we, watching these fools, recognize them for the dopes that they truly are. I'm really happy to welcome Miranda Devine to the podcast. Miranda is an investigative reporter with the New York Post. She's the author of a forthcoming book coming out this fall, Laptop from Hell. She is on the Hunter Biden story, but I don't really want to call it the Hunter Biden story because I think it is actually the Joe Biden story. Miranda, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me. Let's start with a bombshell revelation that you had in the New York Post. You placed Joe Biden, I would say, at the scene of the crime. And what I mean by that is at a face-to-face meeting with a whole bunch of Hunter Biden's corrupt buddies, including top executive at Burisma, the Ukrainian energy company that was paying this dude $83,000 a month for basically nothing, for being a Biden and for being perhaps the bag man for the big guy, Joe Biden. Talk a little bit of, first of all, how did you make this discovery that has evidently gone missed by the entire media? And then talk about the significance of it.
Thanks, Dinesh. Great to be with you. Look, it is a bombshell event because there you have Joe Biden meeting not one of Hunter's clients, which we already knew he had because we had the email from Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop that was from his benefactor at Burisma, a guy called Vadim Pozorowski, saying, thank you for introducing me to your father to have a meeting and spend some time with him. So we knew that had happened, but we didn't know how or when. And you know, the White House and Joe Biden's campaign is never forthcoming. They didn't exactly deny it, but they said that this meeting with this Burisma executive was not on his official diary of the time. Well, we found many emails, and I'm cross-referencing not just the laptop, but the material Tony Bobulinski has given me, also the material that's in the Senate Republican inquiry last year, all those Treasury reports of suspicious activities, this money, millions of dollars sloshing into accounts of businesses associated with Hunter Biden. So when you cross-match everything, suddenly more gems pop out, and this was one of them. And it's a dinner at Cafe Milano, April 17, 2015, and it was a three-for-one deal as far as Hunter was concerned. He had clients from Russia, from Ukraine, and from Kazakhstan who were all giving him millions of dollars, and Joe Biden showed up to just be there, to be the presence there. We don't know what was said, but we do know he was there.
Now, Joe Biden has said, I'm not quoting him, I have never spoken to my son about his overseas business dealings. Doesn't the mere presence of Joe Biden at this kind of a meeting show that that statement has got to be flatly false.
Absolutely. And it's one of many statements that Joe Biden has made over the years, defending himself and saying that he knew nothing about his son's business dealings, which obviously were all about him, because Hunter Biden didn't bring anything to the table personally. He was a crack addict. Everyone can feel sad about that. But his personal life was in shocking disarray. He split with his wife. He was having an affair with his brother's widow. That was tempestuous in itself. He was back and forth to LA, staying at the Chateau Marmont on crack benders. His behavior was so out of control, he was even black banned from the Chateau Marmont. So this is not someone that you would really be willingly paying millions of dollars to be part of your business unless you were getting something else. And that was, of course, the influence of Joe Biden, who was then vice president and had carriage over policies in many of the countries, or all of the countries, that Hunter Biden was monetizing, with his uncle, Joe's younger brother, Jim Biden, who is, I'm told, the brains of the operation.
Now, I think this is the key point, that although people are focusing on, quote, the Hunter Biden story, I just saw Bill O'Reilly says, you know, something like Hunter Biden is a lost soul. I think that's somewhat to miss the point, because the son, Hunter Biden, and the brothers, Jim Biden, and also Frank Biden, who was operating in South America, Costa Rica, places like that. I mean, these were the bag men for Joe Biden. So it seems to me that while the Clintons had a foundation, and that was kind of the conduit for foreign money flowing into the Clinton coffers, Biden set up his operation a little bit differently. It was a little bit more Corleone style, operate through La Familia, so to speak. And so this isn't really a Hunter Biden scandal, is it? Isn't it a Joe Biden scandal? The man in the White House has enriched himself and has all these multiple homes and multiple mansions and so on because his net worth soared dramatically over his career, because he was taking huge dollops of money from multiple foreign governments, including China.
It is a Biden story. Joe Biden himself has operated like this from his very earliest days in Delaware. It's called the Delaware way. It's just this cronyism, quid pro quo, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. It's how he managed to get jobs for family members, particularly for Hunter, very lucrative jobs, get into the Yale, himself these mansions that he lived in. You know, it's all just donors being friendly to him. It's was very well known in the early days that if you help Joe's family, you're helping Joe. So it's an extended family situation. It's this great mantle of privilege that's accorded to anyone with the name Biden. So it's his nieces and nephews and definitely his children. And Hunter was anointed by his father very early on as the money maker. So sadly, his son Beau has died, and he was really the golden boy who was Attorney General of Delaware, set to Joe had him planned to go to the White House. And he's spoken of that himself. And sadly, his life was cut short because he had cancer and died in 2015. But the plan had always been that Hunter would make the money for the family so that Beau could concentrate and Joe could concentrate on being squeaky clean. I mean, Joe describes himself as the poorest member of Congress, and yet he lives like a billionaire. So it's done by bills being paid. He doesn't really have any bills because all those bills get sent to Hunter, and Hunter has complained. We have an email on the laptop. He said to his adult daughter at one point, at least you don't have to give half your income to Pop, meaning Joe. And we know, in other cases, certainly when Joe was leaving the vice presidency, I mean, he wasn't dumb enough to take cash while he was vice president, although his family took millions. But it was after he left that he was, Hunter had organized for him to go into business with him and CEFC, which is the billionaire chairman Yi Jianming, who now has disappeared, thought to be dead in China. And he was the head of this Chinese investment conglomerate that Hunter was in a joint venture with. And this is where Tony Bobulinski came in. And of course, Hunter and his uncle Jim decided to rip off Bob Alinsky and another partner, James Gilliar, and go and do it themselves. And when Bob Alinsky saw the Senate report and saw all these millions of dollars sloshing in from China into associated accounts, he twigged that he had been ripped off, and that was, sparked his revelations.
But now, Miranda, sorry to interrupt you. I just want to jump in here. I want to ask you a question about the Washington Post, because it seems like we're in an age where the media, far from investigating these stories, tries to work to cover up for the Bidens. And here you have Glenn Kessler, the so-called fact checker of the Washington Post. I want to fact check Glenn Kessler a little bit here, because he essentially says, no big deal. He says, first of all, the reason this wasn't on Biden's schedule is he, quote, just stopped by at the last minute. And so there's an effort here to minimize the story, to imply that he wasn't here to talk about any business dealings at all. So give us the scoop on Glenn Kessler and what he's trying to do and why he is deliberately missing the point of what you were reporting.
Well, it is deliberate. I mean, it was astonishing to find that so-called fact check, because all it did was try and minimize any potential wrongdoing by Joe Biden. It was really carrying water for Joe Biden. And why? I mean, extraordinary, and factually incorrect. We published the guest list that Hunter had written to his friend Devin Archer for this upcoming dinner a month before. And on that list were the Kazakhstanis, ambassadors, the Russians, in fact, including Elena Batcherina and her husband, the former corrupt mayor of Moscow, who had wired $3.5 million into an account of an associated business. So, and of course the Ukrainians. So it was pretty obvious. We'd written down that Vadim Pozhorovsky, the Ukrainian executive from Burisma, was on Hunter's guest list from the first days. And yet Kessler says, oh, and Vadim isn't even on the guest list. And I'm like, did you not read the story? How can you fact check a story that you haven't read? And there were lots of other omissions. And he basically tried to characterize it as a last minute thing, when Hunter had said, more than 2 weeks beforehand to the guests that Dad would be coming, but don't tell anyone. It was planned in advance, quite obviously, in Hunter's own words. And yet Kessler's characterizing it as a last minute thing and religious in nature, because Hunter says that really it's a dinner ostensibly about the World Food Program, where he was a board member and sometime chairman. And he invited three World Food Program USA. It's not the UN related thing. It's a USA program which only collects money from Americans. That's its whole role. So there's absolutely no point with them meeting foreigners. But anyway, that was the cover story, which Hunter said it was a cover story by using the word ostensibly. I don't know if Ben Kessler doesn't understand what that word means, but Kessler is trying to characterize it as religious because the head of the then Greek Orthodox Church was one of the guests there, who is a family friend of the Bidens. And his son, Michael Kaloutsos, who is also a friend of Hunter's, who Hunter was actually talking about doing business with him in Greece. So I don't know how Kessler thinks that is making this whole meeting innocent. It just made it preposterous and embarrassed him and, frankly, the Washington Post.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think it was mere stupidity, but I fear it was deliberate. Miranda, we need 100 people like you doing this kind of work, because we're at a time where somebody needs to cast a critical spotlight on the government. Very few people are doing it. You're one of them. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dinesh. It's a pleasure.
Barack Obama is perhaps is truly one of the most nauseating figures, I think, in public life worldwide. I mean, Debbie says that she can hardly look at him without getting acid reflux. But that's Obama. And it's partly because of his sanctimonious style and his fake delivery. Everything about this guy is fake. Let's listen to his latest. Here we go.
There are certain right-wing media venues, for example, that monetize and capitalize on stoking the fear and resentment of a white population that is witnessing a changing America.
So conservatives are the ones who are like monetizing critical race theory? Did we come up with it? Are we the ones who sort of concocted it and pushed it out there? No, the left did. And in fact, Obama is one of the earliest practitioners of this craft, even going back to his days at Harvard Law School. He was the one who introduced Derrick Bell. Derrick Bell is one of the early pioneers of this kind of critical race thinking. Obama was one of his Harvard apostles. And think about what he did in his presidency. Every opportunity he used to stoke racial resentment, to divide the country. Think of how bitter race relations were when this guy left 8 years later. America was a different country, and it was because of the poison that he put into the public stream. Now, then think about the hypocrisy. He's worried about, oh, these guys are monetizing critical race theory. This is a guy, Obama, that has monetized his presidency itself. Here's a guy who's gone from zero to $100 million in no time flat. Here's a guy who has a massive mansion in Kalorama in Washington, D.C. Most presidents, after they finish their terms, they skip town, they leave D.C. Not Obama, because he knows there's still influence to be had, money to be made. Debbie says he's still president. He's still running things. And I'll talk about that on another occasion. Here's a guy, by the way, who also just bought, just last year, I believe it was, or the year before, $12 million oceanfront mansion in Martha's Vineyard. Here's a guy who's been talking about the oceans are rising. He knows they're not rising. So on the one hand, these people put out these fraudulent messages for political purposes. At the same time, their actions show they don't believe a word of it. Obama has not only amassed all his money, he's one of the most stingy, uncharitable people I have ever encountered. His aunt just died a few months ago, literally in Kenya. This is his father's sister. The family had to make a public request for money to bury the woman. Obama obviously wouldn't help. And some of you know, and I've talked before about how several years ago I got a call from George Obama. Now, this is, again, Obama's half-brother. This was from Barack Obama Sr. and another woman, another woman that he married after he had Obama. And George Obama had a child that was very sick in the hospital. And George Obama called me and said, can you please give me $1,000 to pay medical expenses? Now, George Obama is a bit of a scoundrel. So I said, well, hand over the phone to the nurse so I can confirm that this is a genuine medical situation. So he did. And the woman came on. She said, oh, yes, no, we've got George's son here. So I wired him $1,000 from Western Union. But here's the amazing thing. George Obama, I said to him, I said, isn't there somebody else you can call? And George Obama said, no. He couldn't make a call to his own half-brother, Barack Obama, to help him in a time of desperate need. He had to call me. So this shows you the true Obama. Oh, we are our brother's keeper. It's all talk. It's all lies. This man is a narcissistic fraud, probably one of the biggest frauds to walk the continent. Unfortunately, he suckered the American people, and he suckered them twice. People were so hungry to have a black man as president. They thought of Obama as some kind of civil rights guy, the realization of Martin Luther King's dream. Nonsense. This was a guy who essentially was intoxicated by critical race fanaticism. He became the adoring disciple of the very one-legged, alcoholic, wife-beating, anti-colonial father who abandoned him at birth. So this gives you an idea that the demented ideas of the father became the demented ideas of the son. And it's a real American tragedy that this crooked, hypocritical fraud haunts our country still. You all know me not just as a writer and podcaster, but as a movie guy, and here's a movie that I want you to see. Now, for many Americans, Father's Day is a day to celebrate, but for many others, it's a day to get through, because Father's Day really hurts if you don't have a father. Now, the facts are clear. Fatherlessness drives many bad outcomes in America, from teen pregnancy to incarceration. An astounding 85% of youths in prison come from fatherless homes. That's 20 times the national average. But there is a path forward suffered from the grim statistics, and this is why I urge you to order a powerful new film. It's called The Streets Were My Father. It features the journey of three inner-city Chicago men, from fatherlessness to gangs and from life in prison to prison ministry programs that set them on the road to redemption and lives as productive members of society. Here's a short clip from the movie. Listen.
I desired to have a father who would tell me that what I did was wrong.
Debbie and I both saw this movie. It's important. It's inspirational. Here's how you can get the streaming version or DVDs. You go to salemnow.com and buy a copy or copies for anyone you know who doesn't have a father or doesn't believe in the power of God to change lives. Go to salemnow.com. That's salemnow.com and order the movie The Streets Were My Father. Have you seen the Lincoln Project's new commercial celebrating Antifa? In fact, linking Antifa to the boys who stormed the beaches at Normandy. Listen.
The folks at the Lincoln Project are out with a reminder to all.
Who is Antifa? They stormed the beaches of Normandy, parachuted into the French countryside, and gave their lives to face down and fight back against fascism.
This is nauseating, but it's kind of appropriate. First of all, it's great that you have this serial fabulist, Brian Williams, introducing the segment. He's perfect. But then you've got the shamelessly dishonest Lincoln Project people. By the way, these guys present themselves as Republicans. Would any Republican link Antifa with Normandy? I mean, first of all, Antifa itself was formed in Europe in the interwar period between World War I and II. It was allied with the communist parties of Europe. So the boys who stormed the beaches of Normandy would never have anything to do with these people. And look at Antifa now. I mean, look what Antifa does. They target innocent civilians. I mean, the civilians they target aren't fascists. You walk up to a restaurant, there's a bunch of people eating. You start harassing and screaming at them. Are those fascists? What knowledge do you have about their lives at all? They engage in terrorism against businesses and innocent civilians. They assault journalists and police officers. They burn and loot churches and American businesses. They're also leading this insurrectionary war against the U.S. government. Talk about an insurrection. They're it. We saw their insurrection in D.C. We've seen it in almost nonstop in Portland, which seems to be their kind of national headquarters. And this has been going on for a year with the support, by the way, of the left and the Democratic Party. So this is morally obscene to make an equation between the greatest generation, the sacrifices it made to go against Hitler. By the way, if you can match the Antifa ideology, which is socialist in its orientation, it matches the Nazi 25-point program to a T. Several common elements, not the anti-Semitism per se, but certainly all the stuff about economic confiscation, state, you know, everything in the state, nothing outside the state. This is Antifa pure and simple. But we can't expect any honest assessment of this from the Lincoln Project, and neither can we expect that from Brian Williams. Shakespeare said that all that glitters is not gold, and now for centuries, gold has been the standard, as good as gold. Now, look at what's happening in America today. Consumer prices up 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008. We see higher fuel prices, food prices, construction costs, housing prices. Inflation isn't just coming, it's here. Now, have you protected your savings, your investments? If you haven't diversified a portion into precious metals, I think the answer is, unfortunately, no. For many years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried, and many others are, about the regime we have in Washington. Absolutely no sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who I purchased from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right. Through a little known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold like I did before it's too late. I want to pick up an issue I discussed yesterday, which is miracles and the question of whether miracles are possible. Can we believe in miracles in an age of scientific laws, when we believe that there's a world that is run, governed by scientific laws? Now, atheists hate the idea of miracles. They hate the idea of miracles in some way, even more than the idea of God. Why? Well, the idea of God is supernatural. It's in the other realm. But the idea that the supernatural could intervene in the natural, could be part of our everyday world, offends them. They're like, no, you're implying that there's a world behind the world. You're implying that, in a sense, God can reach out from the next world into this one and do things. And we absolutely reject that possibility. Now, some Christians, because they're, you know, they listen to phrases like "listen to the science," get sort of intimidated, and they want to give in on the miracles. They want to basically say, "Well, maybe the miracles aren't really real. Maybe those were just kind of invented by superstitious people who wrote the Bible." I've actually seen absurd writers, liberal Christians, so to speak, who say things like, "Well, you know, maybe Jesus didn't really feed the multitude by multiplying the loaves and the fishes. You know, people probably brought boxed lunch." Or they'll say things like, well, you know, maybe Jesus didn't really walk on water. Maybe there was some sort of a floating platform right below the ocean. Jesus walked on that. Or maybe Jesus didn't come back from the tomb. He didn't really come back. But, you know, his followers believed that he did, and that inspired them, and that's enough. So all of this, I think, is really the surrender of Christianity itself, which stands or falls on the idea that miracles are possible. Now, my argument for miracles is very simple. People believe that miracles are impossible because A, there are laws of nature, B, those laws admit of no exceptions, and C, we know what those laws are. You can see why you need all those three things in order to be able to say, therefore, something that seems to contravene those laws is in fact an impossibility. The laws are fixed. We know they're fixed. Scientific laws are provable, they're verifiable. And my counter-argument is that this is not true. Scientific laws are not provable. They're not verifiable. There may be laws of nature, but if there are, we don't know what they are, or at least we don't know with absolute certainty what they are. Why? Because of the laws of nature, the scientific laws, the empirical laws, are not like mathematical laws. Think of what a mathematical law is. Pythagoras' theorem is a mathematical law, but it operates by the force of logic. If you prove the theorem, you see it's true in all cases. Mathematics itself is pure logic. It doesn't talk about the world at all. Ultimately, you can do mathematics just in your mind. But science is not like that. Science is about the world. Science purports to describe the world out there. Newton's inverse square law, which basically says that the force of gravity between two objects falls off proportionate to the square of the distance between those two objects. That is a description of the world. It's not merely a logical statement. But I would submit that that is a statement that we know to be true based on everything we've seen and observed, but it doesn't operate by force of logic. It's an empirical observation. Like all empirical observations, and this is something, by the way, oddly enough, I learned from David Hume. David Hume, the guy who was a skeptic about miracles, but David Hume himself says that from no amount of empirical observations, however huge, it doesn't matter how many there are, can you draw a general law or a general principle that is necessarily true or that is true as a matter of logic. Why? Because even if you repeat the experiment 10 million times, there could be another time, another place, somewhere else, where if you repeated the experiment one more time, you would find that it is not, in fact, the case. Look, obviously, for those of us who are believers, if you believe in God, you know that God can do miracles. Why? Because the laws of nature themselves have been created by God. God is sort of like the author of a play. Now, there's an internal logic within the play. There's a kind of cause and effect that operates inside the play, inside, let's say, for example, Othello or Hamlet. But is there any doubt that Shakespeare is the creator and is in charge of his own creation? Is there any doubt that if Shakespeare wants to make a modification to Hamlet, he can step right in, pick up his quill pen, and do it? So God is like that. God is not merely the creator of the universe, he's also the sustainer of it. So if he wants to reach into the universe and do something, he obviously can. Now, he doesn't do that very often. I mean, people say, well, God can't keep doing that, Dinesh, because it would cause a major disruption. I agree, and that's why miracles are rare events, and that's why they are major disruptions, and they're meant to be. Why? Because that's why we go, wow! That's why we go, that was a miracle. That was unexpected. That's not the normal course of things. It's only done when God, in a sense, wants to send a message, when he wants to communicate. Very often, not something about the natural world at all, but make a point about a spiritual thing that would seem to demand, at least in this unusual situation, some form of direct, albeit rare, divine intervention.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify.